Is President Barack Obama truly the fulfillment of the dream of Martin Luther King, or a corporate wolf in sheep's clothing? We'll talk to Baltimore-based writer and commentator Jared Ball about whether comparisons between the two men are apt. And, with France now clearly engaged in the violent conflict sweeping northern Mali, are we witnessing some sort of renewed colonial power struggle? And where does the U.S. fit in? Michel Chossadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization tells us what he thinks in the final half hour. On today's program, Obama versus King and the Mali Endgame. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 24th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Benjamin Netanyahu emerged victorious following last Tuesday's elections. The coalition he leads, however, lost nearly a dozen seats in the Israeli parliament, which will compromise his ability to form a stable coalition government. His Likud Beitanu won 31 out of 120 seats, putting it well ahead of the second-place party, the upstart centrist party Yesh Atid, led by popular television personality Yair Lapid. Lapid had campaigned on socioeconomic matters and on removing the exemption from military service for Orthodox Jews. Yehuda Ben-Meir of the Institute of National Studies said of the election results, quote, "The story of this election is a slight move to the center, and above all, the possibility of Netanyahu forming coalition only with his natural parties does not exist. He is definitely going to work for a wider coalition," unquote. Labour emerged third with 15 seats, the ultra-nationalist Jewish Home Party and the ultra-Orthodox Shas Party tied for fourth with 11 seats each, and Hatuna, led by former Foreign Minister Zipi Livni, sits in fifth with 7 seats. 2 out of 3 Israelis showed up to vote, a higher proportion than in past elections. Results could shift dramatically, however, after the vote of serving military personnel are counted, and that comes to us from the UK Guardian. Russia is warning Israel and Western governments against a military attack on Iran, while encouraging the Middle Eastern country to cooperate more with the inspectors looking to monitor Iranian nuclear facilities. The warning by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov came Wednesday at his annual news conference and only hours after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced during his election victory speech that preventing Iran from arming itself with nuclear weapons would be the main challenge of the next government. The Iranian government denies it has nuclear weapons program, arguing its nuclear research is for peaceful purposes only. It has, however, been stalling on efforts to allow admittance by International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors to examine its nuclear sites. That comes to us from Reuters. A severe drought afflicting Brazil is taking its toll on the country's hydroelectric power reserves. Data from Brazil's national grid operator, ONS, reveals that hydroelectric reservoirs in the central west and southeast of the country, which power industrial activity, are operating at 30% capacity. The country's energy demands have soared since the government of President Lula da Silva lifted millions out of poverty over the last decade, thereby fueling a 40% increase in electrical power consumption. Hydroelectric power is the source of 67% of the country's electricity. A similar drought in 2001 led to energy rationing across the country in which citizens had to voluntarily cut back on 20% of their consumption or be cut off. Electricity generation is now supplemented by thermoelectric plants fueled by diesel and natural gas, although with natural gas prices on the increase, current President Rousseff will be hard-pressed to fulfill her pledge of cutting electricity rates by 20%. That comes to us from BBC Brazil, São Paulo. The United States is assisting France in the movement of troops and equipment to Mali to push back Islamic militants who have taken root in the northern part of the country. Reporters have witnessed three C-17 transport planes from the U.S. have landed in Mali Monday and Tuesday morning, and one U.S.-flagged military transport is reported as having left the Istres Air Base in the south of France. According to Tom Saunders of the U.S. military's Africa Command, the airlifts will continue over the next several days. U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has confirmed that the U.S. is also providing intelligence support to the French, but would not confirm if that support includes unmanned drones or refueling tankers for French fighters conducting airstrikes. That comes to us from RT and the New York Times. America's first black president, Barack Obama, was recently sworn into the Oval Office for the second time, a major milestone in the history of American politics. Obama's inaugural address, by coincidence, was given January 21st on Martin Luther King Day, further cementing the tendency among Americans to present Obama as the realization of Dr. King's dream. Not everyone holds the U.S. president in such high-minded terms. One of these critics is Jared Ball. Dr. Jared Ball is an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University, specializing in issues around colonialism, history, and mass media theory. A past contributor to BlackAgendaReport.com, he is co-author with Todd Stephen Burrows of the recently released book A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manning Marable's Malcolm X. His website is imixwhatilike.org. He joins us now from Baltimore. So thank you for joining us, Dr. Ball.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, now, you just heard my introductory remarks. Dr. Ball, I know that you and your fellow contributors at BlackAgendaReport.com have been quite critical of the Obama administration as it's manifested itself in the first term, and particularly critical of the attempts to integrate the career of Barack Obama with the legacy of Dr. King. I wonder if there may be just a few examples you might want to point out to a listening audience, particularly in Canada. You know, Canadians seem to have such a love affair with your president. What are some of the things that you think people should be mindful of when they evoke these sorts of comparisons?
Well, the first is simply that there really is no comparison. The two do not have any similar origins in terms of their political career, which I think is a good place to start. And then, of course, because of that, they have almost nothing in common in terms of the decisions they make or the policies they support or the positions they take publicly on anything from race to domestic or foreign affairs. But to start with, it is important to remember that Dr. King was a product of a liberation movement. He was brought into the movement. He was encouraged by the movement to take a leadership role. He was pushed by the movements in this country and around the world to take ever increasingly radical positions. And he became a threat to the United States and was thusly assassinated. Because of that. And again, I mean, I do think it's important that the Global Research website and others are doing important work in reminding people of the 1999 trial, where a jury hearing all the evidence involved concluded that there was a conspiracy involving the federal government in the assassination of Dr. King. And one of the reasons I think that that's so hard for people to understand or interpret, of course, secondly to the fact that that trial got very little coverage, is that they are not aware, most of us are not made aware of the increasingly radical trajectory that Dr. King had been on since he's often frozen in the 1963 I Have a Dream speech. So we never hear of him referring to that speech as, you know, that dream as having become a nightmare, or his increasing criticism of capitalism, white supremacy, and militarism, and specifically white liberals and the black bourgeoisie. He became a staunch critic of those groups as not contributing appropriately to the struggle. Barack Obama, on the other hand, is imposed upon us from the exact opposite political trajectory. He is a Democratic Leadership Council inspired Democratic Party candidate, vetted by the right wing of the Democratic Party, and is seen as someone, as Paul Street has identified in one of his books on the subject, where Obama was described as being black but not civil rights black. He is the most heavily Wall Street funded candidate in the history of presidential politics in the United States. And his cabinet, he stocked with mostly Clintonite types, holdovers, and the very people who not only increased the gap between rich and poor, but increased the incarceration rates of black people and expanded wars at that time, expanded invasions and military strikes around the world. And then certainly Obama has extended even Bush's military policies and worsened them in ways that a white president could not get away from. So even as I've tried to say, even if someone is prone to like or support President Obama, they have to do so consciously aware of the fact that he is decidedly different than a Dr. King, at which point that's a separate conversation. But there is no way for anyone to look at the historical record at what these men have contributed, said, or done and see one is having anything to do with the other. In fact, quite the opposite, that Obama is the antithesis to Dr. King. He is the system's response to a Dr. King and a movement that produced Dr. King.
Hmm. Now, you rightly point out, like, Obama is Obama is a figure within a system. I wonder what you would say to some, you know, thoughtful figures who still maintain that support for Obama, sort of with the idea that that he's basically a good guy but in a bad place. He was doing the best that he can under these circumstances with a Republican-backed, all those Republicans he's got to contend with and with, all these other special interests. I mean, what would you say to that kind of argument?
Well, again, I mean, at a certain point, everyone has to get past symbolism, emotion, fantasy and hope, and look at the real material conditions, the real impact, the actual policies undertaken, the statements made, the statements contradicted, and then make an assessment. And I think what usually is often the case is that, in part because we are all overworked and overstressed and undersupported in our daily lives, we just don't have the time to keep up with everything at the rates we're supposed to, and we're not encouraged to, primarily because the media environment, particularly in the United States, is as horrific as an environment as I think could exist anywhere. So it's very difficult for, I think, many people to keep up with these things. Then, of course, we have levels, as I would argue, that sort of insulate the majority of the population from ever hearing reality, and they, whether it's politicians or even academics, so-called pundits, folks who certainly entertainers who are given, I think, undue time to discuss politics. We are not given anything by way of encouragement to look deeper to understand what is actually happening. Mm. But add to that, Obama's brilliant. For whatever I might think of him politically, or even character-wise, or whatever, he is brilliant. He is talented. He is one of the most skillful people in front of a camera, in front of a microphone. And so he poses for me quite a serious opponent, in that he is able to obfuscate and reshape himself depending on his environment. And he makes allusions to Dr. King in his inaugural speech, or he'll make allusions to progressive statements. He'll co-opt Cesar Chavez's phrase, si se puede, and turn it into yes we can for a Democratic Party Wall Street candidate. But if you read his books, I mean, I take him at his word, and I take the word of those who support, and what I can see from my own eyes and what I read, that he is as smart as people say he is. And then when I read, Dreams of My Father, or, for instance, what he said when he wasn't sure, at least as far as we know, that he was going to be a candidate of this nature, He very clearly understands how race works. He understands how class and economics work. He understands how inequality works. He has a working knowledge of the social movements to which he will allude to some sort of connection. Obviously, you know, so he knows enough to cloak himself in a black struggle in particular and in a black cultural environment, so to speak. He knows how to cloak himself in progressive, garnish, so to speak. He knows what he's doing. So he's skillful at manipulating his audience, and it becomes very difficult to break through all of that. And then I would just add lastly that, you know, sort of where I started, that the desperation in this country, the suffering in this country, the unrequited struggles in this country have all led to a lot of people wanting this to be more than what I think all of us deep down know it is. And it's a formidable thing, and it's something we've never seen before. So I think even a lot of great people that we would have looked to for an analysis of this, in the past, have themselves been deluded by the moment and by the overwhelming support in the community, and have not wanted to raise enough of a critique about what he's actually doing and the policy he actually supports, which is why I find it to be increasingly disrespectful that he would make these, he and his camp would make these connections to a Dr. King and to a liberation struggle that Obama has absolutely nothing to do with and has absolutely no support for.
Now, speaking of, you just mentioned manipulating the public. I was wondering if you heard his inaugural address, and beyond the references to Dr. King in that speech, was there anything else about it in terms of what he said or what he didn't say that really stood out in your mind as something to be concerned about?
Well, in an attempt to a rhetorical flourish to appease those who would be looking for that connection to Dr. King, since he and his camp had been so quick to make it, he did say the word poor one time, but he never actually used the word poverty. He certainly never said anything about addressing or going, extending a war against poverty or addressing the need to end poverty or the increasing inequality between rich and poor, between black and white, and so on. And he just makes his allusion. He just keeps making these references to the middle class, which is really just code word for we're just going to help people who already have some means to help themselves so that they will vote for me and protect me. But he also added, he had a few references that were more akin to the old notion of manifest destiny, where he said outright that God has granted the United States this privileged position of power, and therefore it is our duty to extend peace and democracy into the world as if that's what's being done with his drone strikes, in fact, having killed at least three people with a drone strike the day he's giving his inauguration in Yemen. So, I mean, he certainly did not say any of the things that one who would know anything about Dr. King or that movement would be looking for. He said very little that I think anyone who would be hopeful that he would be doing anything simply progressive would look for. His claims to ending war is hard to believe, given that he continues these drone strikes. The private security forces that are sent over in Iraq are still there. As far as I know, they're still there in greater numbers than official U.S. service personnel. So when he says he's drawing down the troops, he's not talking about the majority of the people who are still over there fighting and killing and, as far as I could ever tell, interrupting progressive political development in Iraq. He's still hostile and bellicose when talking about Iran and this need to sort of protect against a nebulous and never-ending terrorist network. So I mean, when he makes his empty statements about adhering to the Constitution and living up to the Founding Fathers, there's certainly nothing progressive or radical in that, given that many of the Founding Fathers, as far as I could tell, are not worth honoring that way, and the Constitution is ultimately a document that continues to protect slavery. So I don't, you know, so anyway, I was not aware of anything in his speech that would give hope to anyone with a forward-thinking, progressively political mind, or anyone who knew anything about Dr. King.
I was wondering if we could maybe switch gears a little bit. With his second term coming up, he's nominated a number of people to be key players in his administration. John Brennan is the new CIA head that he's nominated. Hillary Clinton is going to be replaced by Senator Kerry. There's the White House Chief of Staff, Jack Lew, is going to replace Timothy Geithner. Chuck Hagel, the new Secretary of Defense, and he's apparently made some controversial remarks with regard to Israel and Iran. So I'm wondering, if structure is strategy in slow motion, what would you project, given those picks, about what we can expect from U.S. Domestic and foreign policy going ahead?
Well, I mean, Brennan was on his, whatever the team is called, that determines who gets bombed each week with the drone strikes. So all I can tell is that would be sort of more institutionalized within the CIA, who continues to control its own drone strike capability and apparatus, you know, some say in a way that's almost autonomous from the president himself anyway. Some have said positively the hope is that since Chuck Hagel and John Kerry both served in Vietnam and have actually seen combat, which is something foreign to most of the people who send us to war, that this might be a step in the right direction. But I see no evidence of that. I mean, there's certainly nothing that I could identify in the political career of John Kerry, and to a lesser extent Chuck Hagel, that would suggest that they are going to extend you know, peace into the world and reduce America's military footprint in the world, or the United States' footprint in the world. Jack Lew is more of the same sort of institutional politician and corporate favoring appointee as well. In other words, I don't necessarily see from this any what could possibly lead to any radical change in foreign policy. And I mean, I know that Hagel's comments about the Israel's lobbying power within the United States have gotten him some attention. But he's, if I remember correctly, he backed away from those comments anyway. They've certainly never led to an actual discussion of what is the impact of the Israeli lobby in American foreign policy. I can't say from these appointments that we could expect any major radical changes coming in the future. I don't see... you know, Jack Lew, as far as I'm aware, is more of an extension of Geithner as opposed to some sort of departure. There's nothing that I see as a sign that anything is going to change. And the thing that I failed to mention thus far that I think is always important to remind them is that I don't see anybody in this administration willing or able to resist what is ever encouraging Obama to continue this militarization of the African continent with AFRICOM. Either. And that to me is as much a concern as anything else that the president is or is not doing. In terms of the institutionalization of policy or ideas, I don't see that what's coming in the second term is going to be any different or any better.
If I could possibly offer one last withering attempt to defend Obama. Some people have pointed out, well, you know, as difficult as the situation might be right now, I mean, wouldn't things be a lot worse if we had somebody like Mitt Romney or John McCain in power? What would you say to that kind of, sort of like lesser of two evils argument?
Well, you know, you mentioned Black Agenda Report, and though I'm no longer a columnist there, I do think that Glenn Ford is to be credited and commendated for being among the first, if not the first, or one of the most open proponents of this idea that Obama is not the lesser of two evils; he's the more effective of two evils. That is, that Obama is getting away with things that no white president could get away with. And I think those who have orchestrated his two terms are well aware of that. As I mentioned, the militarization of the African continent, going as he did in his first term and telling African leadership that the problems with the continent are not Western imperialism or neocolonialism, but African corruption, bombing Libya, extending the drone warfare, extending the military budget beyond what Bush has done, saying, lecturing black fathers in the United States about being, about their insufficient, parenting skills. These are things that no white president could ever get away with without major protest. Extending the forgiving the warrantless wiretapping, extending Guantanamo Bay. There are more. He's had more cases brought against whistleblowers than any previous president. He's deported more Latinos than any president previously. He supported the border wall, that is, the fence with Mexico. None of these policies would be. it's literally is laughable to think that if a white president or McCain or Romney were elected, that if they were at the head of these policies, it is laughable to think that the left, that the black community, that well-meaning people everywhere would not be far more riled up and far more engaged in protest. They wouldn't have had the prescient brilliance to, as the Washington Post said of him, make Al Sharpton a surrogate for the White House to tell black people that what Obama is doing is good for them, regardless of whether that is true. They wouldn't have had the prescience or the ability to have special invitation press conferences with black journalists and black bloggers to assure that there is, again, this insulated wall in the media to protect him against righteous and just criticism. Certainly, if Romney or McCain were presiding over the increased level of mass incarceration and political imprisonment that we see happening here in the United States, there is simply no way we could suspect or suggest or conclude, rather, that there would be this level of apathy, this level of defense for that president. So I have to agree with Glenn Ford that he is not the lesser of two evils. He is the more effective evil, and he is funded and supported and surrounding himself with the exact same people who have brought us these crises and who have continued to make them worse.
Well, Jared Ball, these insights, these viewpoints that you put forward are, I believe, pretty foreign to most people who consume mainstream media, so I'm very delighted and feel privileged to have you expressed them on our program. Thank you very much for these perspectives.
Thank you, and if I can, I do have to make a shameless plug for a book my co-editor just put out, A Live Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X, where some of these same politics and some of the same criticism that we've discussed here today are brought to bear in terms of what has been done to Malcolm X's image and the role that Manny Marable, Viking Press, have played in that and the way that there has been a similar attempt to connect President Obama to Malcolm X in terms of political lineage. So we invite people to check that out at imixwhatilike.org. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dr. Jared Ball is an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University. He's a commentator and writer. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partner campus community radio stations across the country. We are also podcast at the site for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. On January 11th of this year, at the invitation of the Malian president, France started launching airstrikes on territory in northern Mali controlled by Islamic militant groups. Days later, an attack on the BP Statoil Sonatrach in Aminas gas field complex in neighboring Algeria ensued, with 41 Westerners being kidnapped. Algeria's efforts to rescue the hostages led to a bloodbath. 69 people, including 39 foreigners, are believed to be dead as of Wednesday, January 23rd. Michel Chossadovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and founder and head of the Center for Research on Globalization. We asked him about the players involved in the current conflict and what he saw as the broader geostrategic factors in play.
Historically, Al-Qaeda, the network Al-Qaeda, which is a nebulous a set of organizations, is considered to be an intelligence asset of the CIA. It goes back to the Soviet-Afghan War. It is presented to public opinion as an outside enemy, and that the Western world is combating terrorism. But when you start to analyze this more carefully, you realize that most of these organizations were trained and recruited in the heyday of the Soviet-Afghan War. And the architect of the terrorist attack on the BP Statoil Aminas gas field complex is a leader called Mokhtar Belmokhtar. He is head of an Al-Qaeda-affiliated organization called the Masked Brigade, or those who sign with blood. But when you look at his history, you realize that he was in fact recruited by the CIA back in the late 80s, early 90s to go and fight in Afghanistan at a time when the CIA was in fact supporting the jihadists. And this is no trivial matter, because those recruits went through the training, the indoctrination in the madrasas, in the guerrilla training camps funded by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and supported by the CIA and its affiliate in Pakistan, the Inter-Services Intelligence. And so that, in effect, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is, from an intelligence point of view, an intelligence asset. I mean, the CIA will probably say, well, there was a blowback. They went against us in the wake of the Cold War. But there's ample evidence that these organizations, these terrorist organizations, are covertly supported by the Western powers. In fact, there's even there's even a public acknowledgement. If we look at Syria, we see that the factions in Syria, the terrorist factions in Syria, Al-Qaeda linked, and they're supported by NATO. And they're financed by Qatar, and they're financed by Saudi Arabia. Now, we have a similar situation in the Islamic Maghreb. These organizations ultimately they bear the footprints of the CIA. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that the West is behind this particular incident, but it cannot be dissociated from the fact that these various Al-Qaeda factions are covertly supported and also funded by several of the United States allies, including Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Now, I just wanted to reference quickly, there was an interview recently on RT in which they approached the British ambassador to Algeria, and he had made the comment that, like, when the interviewer pressed him on the point that there's sort of a double standard. On the one hand, they are supporting these Syrian militant groups, these militant groups in Syria, and they're wanting to stop these militant militant groups in Mali. Basically, he's explaining, well, in Syria, these are the people rising up against a brutal dictator, and whereas it's different in Mali. What do you say to that kind of double standard in terms of who the states like France and the United States are, you know, in terms of whether they support or appear to support these militant groups?
Well, it's a nonsensical statement, because the mercenaries which are fighting in Syria are also the same mercenaries which are fighting in Mali. They're recruited internationally. You have Libya Islamic Fighting Group mercenaries in Syria, but you also have them in Mali and Algeria. There are links between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb and the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. I think what the U.S. ploy has been over the last 30 years is twofold. One, it will use the Islamic brigades as their foot soldiers, i.e. Libya, with the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which waged a war against Gaddafi. They were supporting them covertly. They had special forces in their ranks. Syria, the Free Syrian Army, integrated by jihadist Salafist groups, supported covertly by Western intelligence with special forces in their ranks, committing atrocities, trained and recruited in the Gulf states, financed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia, supported by Turkey. Mali and Somalia and other countries might be, maybe Nigeria, could be considered as a different context where terrorists are actually planted and supported, and they create conditions which will then lead to destabilization and to the justification for Western, intervention. In both cases, it's Western intervention. But here, the terrorists in the Maghreb and in Mali are considered as the bad guys, and consequently, the Western forces must come to the rescue of the government. Whereas in Syria, the terrorists are considered as the good guys, and the West must intervene on the side of the terrorists against the government. So that you have, but in both cases, the terrorists are being used as a means to destabilize sovereign countries.
Now, you also mentioned, you also mentioned in your article that there is a group called the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, which is a Tuareg, what you would call a Tuareg secular nationalist independence movement. So it's not, as I understand it, one of these Islamic groups. Is this simply a situation where you see the convergence of their aims with those of the international players within Mali?
Well, let's say that the movement, the nationalist movement of the Tuareg, has been ongoing for quite some time. The Tuareg live in the northern part of Mali. They're a pastoral community. They are nomadic. They move across into Algeria, back to Mali, into Mauritania. And their movement was quite separate from that of the Islamists. At one point, there was some collaboration between the two movements, and in recent developments, the Islamists have gone against them. They're not involved in any kind of religious ambitions, but there are factions within that movement. And there are some factions which are pro-jihadists and others which are not. The fact of the matter is that the insertion of the jihadists into that particular part of northern Mali is also destabilizing the nature of that resistance movement.
So we're sort of seeing, because it sounds kind of similar to Afghanistan, in the sense that you've got what you're identifying as these intelligence assets that are basically trying to destabilize the politics for in the interests of these foreign brokers. I guess I'm just wanting to inspect a little bit what the aims are, at least in the case of Mali. What are the strategic assets that these international players are trying to get hold of or further? What is your sense of the strategic aspects of this?
First of all, I should say that it's distinct from Afghanistan in that if you go back to the Soviet-Afghan War, which started in 1979 under the Carter administration, started supporting the Mujahideen, they were considered as freedom fighters. Those were the words of Ronald Reagan at the time. The Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, was considered as a liberation movement, and America came to their rescue or came to their support. In fact, they created them. They created the whole jihadist movement. Now, in this particular case, the jihadists are the bad guys, and you intervene on the side of the government, but ultimately the end result is one of justifying a military intervention by the United States, by France, with a view to recolonizing that area. Now, I have, I think that many people are saying, and I think it has to be qualified, that this is a recolonization by France. It's not a recolonization by France. France already has a historical role in that region, and in other words, what was formerly French West Africa and French Equatorial Africa, and in many of these countries, France is losing ground to the and is being, in a sense, shoved out by the United States. And this has taken on different forms. What I'm suggesting there is that, in effect, the broader long-term objective of the United States is to establish a U.S. sphere of influence in areas of Africa which were formerly under French jurisdiction. I'm talking about the colonial period, but also the post-colonial period. Mali, Niger, Senegal, all these countries were in the French orbit. And what is now happening is a process whereby the former colonial power, ironically, is intervening on behalf of Washington, but which is ultimately being displaced. The United States wants to control the armed forces. It's got AFRICOM. It has agreements with African countries. It also is displacing France with regard to the economic cleavages. The CFA franc was destabilized in the 1990s. And what is at stake here, and it's very important to look at the map, is a vast territory extending from the Atlantic Ocean, Mauritania, right through across the continent to the western border of the Sudan, or what was previously called the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, which is now more and more within the U.S. Sphere of interest, or within the Anglo-American sphere of influence. So that essentially U.S. geopolitics is based on redrawing the map of Africa, which was established at the Berlin Conference 1884-1885 between the essentially European powers, and essentially establishing its grip over a vast area sub-Saharan Africa, which corresponds to that belt of the Sahel, immediately south of the Saharan Desert. And it's an area of tremendous wealth. There's gold, there's uranium, there's petroleum, there's natural gas, strategic minerals, and ultimately that is the longer-term objective. People might say, well, this sounds somewhat unusual, given the fact that François Hollande, the French president, is intervening. But ultimately, François Hollande is not serving the French Republic. He's not serving the economic interests of the French Republic. He's serving the geopolitical interests of the United States. And if we look at the experience of Rwanda, how a country where French was an official language barely 20 years ago, and following the genocide and the incursion and installation of the Kagame government under the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, what do we have? English is established as an official language. French remains as official language, but it's no longer taught at the university. The university is now fully 100% English. Secondary schools in Rwanda were bilingual up until 2009. Now secondary schools are only in English. Okay? So there you are. In the matter of 20 years, Rwanda is now becoming part of a new set of cleavages, with English being the official language. The president of Rwanda doesn't even speak French. Okay,
Professor Chostovsky, what you're telling me about essentially the France is consenting to this handover of its historic colonial territory to the United States, and it sounds reminiscent of the Indochina Wars, where you had that territory in Southeast Asia which the France had previously controlled, and it then seemed to move into the U.S. sphere of interest, or that was what the game plan was. Why? I'm not sure you've adequately explained this. Why is France consenting to this?
Well, France is consenting to this because, on the one hand, they want to share the spoils of a U.S.-led military intervention. But I think France is collaborating in this U.S. project because the French presidency is increasingly responding to American interests. We saw that during the presidency of Nicolas Sarkozy. I think Jacques Chirac was a watershed. Okay, but the increasingly France is obeying orders. It is not acting as a major power on the geopolitical chessboard, so that the French presidency is complicit in pursuing the interests of the United States at the expense of France, and that was very clear under Sarkozy, but it seems that the new president François Hollande is doing exactly the same thing. And what I'm also suggesting, and that's something which has to be further investigated, is that the actual choice of a head of state and a foreign minister. We had the foreign minister Bernard Kouchner. We know that Bernard Kouchner was a pro-U.S. Okay, so that was under Sarkozy. Now, what I'm saying is that when political appointments in a country like France are influenced by major financial interests, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, the oil companies, and so on, you then have a situation where politics in France is subservient to those interests, okay? And it is also subservient, in a sense, to U.S. imperial policy, which supports those corporate interests. So we're no longer in the realm of competing colonial powers. We're in the realm of what I would describe euphemistically as the French-American War. We had a Spanish-American War. Americans remember it very well, going back to the late 19th century, where Spanish territories eventually all got gobbled up by the United States. Okay, and we can look at other colonial possessions, like let's say Indonesia, which belonged to the Netherlands. The Japanese, former Japanese colonies of the Great East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, so that essentially, in the course of the last 100 years, the United States has been gaining influence, not necessarily formal colonization, because that in effect is no longer what is sought, but is gaining influence and over territories which were previously under the dominion of Spain, Portugal, Japan, Holland, and of course France. And here we still have France as exerting a major influence in the African continent, being gradually displaced by the U.S. militarization of the continent, the control that the United States exerts on monetary aspects, the dollarization of the continent, that's also another dimension, the role of the IMF World Bank reforms, which very much obey the Washington consensus, that has played a role in destabilizing these African economies, and so on. So that I see it as a historical process of displacement of France from its traditional territories, which it conquered starting in the late 19th century. Mali was conquered. I mean, all these, this was a military agenda, and it followed suit from the Berlin Conference of 1885.
There's been some suggestions that some of these attacks by what you identify as these intelligence assets among the Al-Qaeda affiliates, that they've been assisted by the groups that are now active in Libya. So,
well, absolutely. First of all, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, they more or less signed an agreement or established a relationship in 2007. They're very closely knit. The two organizations are closely knit. They intertwine, so to speak. And bear in mind the attack on the BP Statoil facility in Amenas, the Amenas gas field complex, is located right at the border with Libya, and one would suspect that Libyan fighters are involved. So that. But we have a lot of evidence pointing to the support of not only the United States, but British MI6, British Special Forces, to support of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. We also know that group is also being active in Syria, so that, in effect, the war on Libya the war in Libya was quite different, because they were supporting the Islamists, and now they're coming to the rescue of the government against the Islamists. But if we want to look at it historically, I'd say that Libya, the war in Libya, and the war on Mali and Algeria are intimately related. They're part of a roadmap, they're part of of several stages, and this particular war is a follow-up of the war on Libya. Libya was conquered because it has 3.5% of global oil and gas reserves, which is approximately double those of the United States of America for a population of less than 7 million people. It's tremendous wealth, but it is also the gateway to that sub-Saharan belt, the Sahelian belt, geographically. If you look at the map, you can see how Algeria and Libya, really constitute a frontier to a vast area of sub-Saharan Africa.
Hmm. Now, Professor Chossudovsky, I remember that around the time of the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, there were there was a lot of buzz on the internet about a book called The Grand Chessboard by Zbigniew Brzezinski, which was essentially that what you just said, a roadmap saying, you know, where the next major wars are going to be fought. I'm wondering if there's any kind of a, you know, documentation you could point to that can give us a clear idea of what's next in terms of Mali and the rest of Sudan, or of the rest of Africa.
Well, I can't make any predictions with regard to U.S. NATO military planning, but certainly what is ongoing is, first of all, a globalization of NATO. And that is well brought out in the recent book of Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. But it's also the establishment of a global military agenda. This is not new, because the United States has established regional commands. But the most recent regional command which it has established is U.S. AFRICOM. And we see already... We see various things happening in the African continent. We see attempts to destabilize by creating ethnic strife. We see it in Nigeria. We see it in the Central African Republic, Chad, Niger, of course, Mali, and of course, Somalia. We also see the use of the drone attacks, which are, I think, increasingly going to be applied to police this vast continent. We see also the involvement of the United States and Britain in the Congo, in Rwanda, in Sudan. It's a war for natural resources. It's not strictly a war for oil. There's tremendous mineral wealth. There's strategic minerals in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's very difficult at this stage to identify a sequence or a roadmap. I should mention that if you look at the project of the New American Century, which was really the cornerstone of the neoconservative team of the former President George W. Bush, what they posit in that document is not necessarily a sequence of military operations, but the adoption of simultaneous actions. They talk about theater wars simultaneously implemented in different parts of the world. The Brzezinski approach, which broadly coincides with Democratic Party, is somewhat different. It applies more conventional warfare as opposed to the Blitzkrieg, non-conventional warfare, I'm sorry, as opposed to conventional warfare. And there the emphasis is much more on destabilization, covert operations, and so on, with a view to then picking up the pieces later on.
Okay. Well, Professor Chossudovsky, we really appreciate that analysis. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He's the award-winning author and emeritus professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and he's also the author of the book Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War. The Global Research News Hour is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM and on our partner stations across the country. You can download our podcasts from the Center for Research on Globalization's website at globalresearch.ca. I am host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.